Hello and welcome to the Underwater Sunshine Podcast. I am your host, Adam Duritz, and here is my compatriot,
James Campion. Look, I'm slow again.
What?
I'm slow again. I'm back to the first two podcasts where you were like reprimanding me.
James, wake up.
Where the hell are you? So this is one of the first ones we've done in a long time where we don't really have a subject, and I think it's kind of cool. It's a tightrope walk that we're going to do, so we'll see how it goes. Sound good to you?
Tell you later.
So how you been, by the way? How's things?
Pretty good. We just had a crazy week last week. We saw a ton of plays. We just saw Avengers Infinity War. Have you seen that?
No,
I haven't seen that. You've got kids. You can't possibly have seen it.
No, I mean, I'm not as big into the superhero movies as
fucking
you are.
Fucking amazing.
Yeah, I heard.
It was fucking amazing. Don't come to me with what you're into and not into. It was fucking amazing. I don't know what to say about it other than, like,
fucking amazing.
I was stunned. I sat there with my jaw on my lap the entire fucking movie. Just kind of, wow. I mean, first of all, it is devastating at the end. It ends. I've never seen anything end like this since. The
Empire
only
Strikes
thing
Back.
I can think about is Empire,
Empire Strikes,
Strikes
Back.
Back.
That's what I heard.
Nothing else left me with the whoa, 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 whoa. The devastation at the end of Empire Strikes Back, that's what this was like. And the thought that you're going to have to wait a year.
Well, I hate that. That's what I hate about it. That's what pissed me off about it. You had to wait 3 years for Empire. But let me ask you a couple of things, because a couple of people have told
but
me about
this. But we remember
film.
That. Before you say that, though, how do you remember Empire Strikes Back now? In your memory, how was it?
I thought it was good. It's definitely probably the second best of the Star Wars films.
Oh, yeah, really? I was going to go with best, but...
Really? I've heard that.
What's your favorite one? The first one?
Oh, yeah. Or, excuse me, four. Episode. Here's one for you. You ready for Generations? So, my nephew, Ty, is at my place a couple of years ago, or I'm at his place, and we're talking, and he's like, I've never seen the first Star Wars. So I'm like, excuse me. He's like 12 or 13 at the time. I'm like, all right, that's it. I'm going to get a Blu-ray version of it. And somebody was selling it on eBay because you had to buy all three of the films together. I got the first, what we consider the first, 1977, Episode 4, A New
all
Hope.
Right.
But you know where this is going. So
yeah.
I get this thing. I get it all set up. He comes to visit for Memorial Day. Put it on. He's like, this is Episode 4. I'm like, what does that mean? He goes, I'm talking about the first one. I'm like, what, the sixth one?
No, it's the fourth one. The first one's the fourth one.
Yes.
The fourth one's the first one.
Exactly. Very good.
Yeah, I get it.
So Empire's your favorite. So you
I don't know.
Dark
favorite. The first two are so good.
They are.
Those are the only flawless ones to me. Although I have enjoyed the last couple as well. But
yeah, me too. I'm not one of those people. I was very entertained. I love seeing the older characters, especially now since Carrie Fisher's left us. Seeing her again in a dramatic way towards the end. I mean, it just, but of course, like the usual complaints, it's the same plot. They're just putting new people in. They're selling us the same thing. Give us something new. I get it. But for me, it took me right back to being 14 years old and seeing the first one again in the
Yeah,
Bronx.
I've liked those. I really liked Rogue One. I'm excited about Solo.
Yes.
But
getting back to
Infinity War.
Right.
I'll tell you one thing. And it's never been done before. I mean, you can kind of say it with Star Wars. It's the only thing that comes close, although, you know, the first movie's great, the second movie's great, and then, to me, it's a world of mediocrity, But, man, I mean, 10 years ago, they make Iron Man, and I remember going to the, I don't know if it's really called a premiere, the Cinema Society had a screening of it, like, in the basement of the Soho Grand, in the screening room down there. Andrew Safier has this thing called the Cinema Society, and he shows movies, you know. It's pretty cool. I don't really think of them as premieres because they're generally pretty small screenings, but they often have people from the movies come down and talk about it, you know. And I remember going to see the first Iron Man, you know, and I was really good friends with Robert Downey when we were, you know, living out in L.A. I hadn't seen him in a while, you know, and he's just so good in it, you know, and they really nailed it. And that's like not a... I mean, for me as a comic book geek, Iron Man, of course, is a big character. But for the public at large, you know, DC had all those. You know, they got Batman, they have Superman, they have Wonder Woman. Pretty big cultural things. Marvel really had Spider-Man.
And they could never make a decent Fantastic Four.
And
they
tried with the Hulk. Right, this Fantastic Four.
Yeah, right. They couldn't make a decent film of those. I mean,
no.
And the other thing, too, is...
Well, they didn't make those films.
Right.
You know, that's the thing. They'd been licensing out, you know, to Sony the Spider-Man movies, which there were. I thought Sam Raimi did some great ones. That was the smart thing then, too. Hiring the guy from the Evil Dead movies to come make the Spider-Man movies was kind of genius.
Yes. And those are my favorite of the films. Yeah.
And but they licensed out the Fantastic Four several times to Fox, which was disasters. And they, you know, licensed out the X-Men to Fox, which occasionally was really good.
Yeah, well, it did very, very well. They'd made a ton of those, but I'm not an X-Men fan. I kind of put this, it's funny, I know where you're going with this, but I put the X-Men in that second wave. It was even Son of Origins when we talked about me reading Stan Lee's Origins of Marvel Comics, which inspired me to be a writer when I was a kid. Then he had a Son of Origins. Son of Origins had X-Men, Iron Man.
Right, yeah.
Silver Surfer, I think, is in that. There's like, so
I don't
I'm saying.
I have it here at the book.
Yeah. Iron Man is like in that second wave, and it's probably my, next to those Raimi Spider-Mans, it's probably my second favorite of the Marvel movies.
Well, it's a great movie, you know, and I mean, I will say this. As a little kid, I liked the X-Men. I was never too caught up in it. The real thing that happens with them, though, is when Chris Claremont, the writer, and John Byrne, the artist, revitalize the X-Men. Yes. At a certain point.
Late
80s. They bring some characters in, like they brought Wolverine, who'd been in a Hulk comic before that. And they take the whole concept of X-Men and mutants and turn it into a referendum on racism, basically. And they do that. And that is what interests people in the X-Men after that. They read a series of brilliant comics dealing with the discrimination. I mean, that was already partially in there because they had Sentinels before that. But they really did a great job of storytelling with it.
Right.
And they came up with some great characters, like, you know, they really made Wolverine into a great character, Nightcrawler. They did the whole Phoenix thing. You know, there was some cool stuff there. But, you know, and I think Bryan Singer did some good stuff with the movies, especially the first two. I think that X-Men First Class movie was a really good movie. Whatever. But starting with the Iron Man movie and having the thing at the end of it, which they almost didn't do, of putting in
like a little epilogue.
A little epilogue with Nick Fury saying to him about the Avengers Initiative. Yeah. And then what's the next one after that? It's
That one
they do a Hulk movie, which is kind of like falls apart, but because they don't use what's his name, Edward Norton, and they get rid of him after that. But at the end of that one, I think is when they show like Thor's hammer in a ditch,
and then they
do the Thor movie, which turned out really well, and you know, introduced us to Hawkeye, and it's possible Iron Man 2 was before that, which is a crappy movie. It's an okay movie, but it has Black Widow in it, you know, and. You know, maybe that's the one where the end of it, they have the Thor's hammer sitting there at the end.
But I do remember that. So I saw, I think it was the second one with, what's his face in there?
It's Mickey Rourke, yeah.
Rourke,
playing
right.
Whiplash, which
that's
is okay.
The last time I saw it.
But it's not a great movie, but it does introduce Scarlett Johansson as this Black Widow, which is pretty, and the fight choreography on Black Widow in that movie is enormously influential because that starts to influence all this female fighting movies that happen after that, like, you know, whether it's from Mission Impossible, you know, this the sort of acrobatic jumping up, wrapping your legs around, flipping them over, the sort of that fight choreography gets from there to Atomic Blonde last year has a lot of stuff like that.
I always credited the Kill Bills for that. Where does that?
Well, I think it's very different. That's the sword fighting thing. It's a
like a kung fu, more of a kung
fu.
Yeah,
but I think
homage.
You know, they realize how important that was in those movies, and you know, it's been important in the Hong Kong movies forever.
Right.
You know, he brought that sort of back into popularity in America. You know. And throughout these movies with these tags at the end building, then you have, you know, Captain America, which takes place during World War II.
You really love those. I mean, you've been counting those.
I mean, I like the Captain America. The first one is an okay movie, the World War II movie. It's pretty good.
Yeah, you've always said
that. The second one, though,
World War II movie.
You know, it leads him into the Avengers because it leads into modern times. And that, you know, having had like five movies at that point, to bring them together in a team-up movie like that, who had ever waited like 5 years to do something like that before? To make characters that you were invested in, all these characters, and then bring them together in a movie, that's like unheard of. And then to continue doing it, like, they were smart. They hired those guys, the Russo brothers, after that, who came from, they directed a lot of episodes of Community, I think. That's the TV show they worked on. And there's something else that I'm not thinking of right now. But those guys came in and had Kenneth Branagh do the Thor movie, which I thought was smart. They picked directors you wouldn't really expect, you know, and James Gunn to come in and do
Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, the Guardians of the Galaxy.
Which was, those are my favorite. And I thank you for that. You turned me on to that. One day we're in here working on the book talking, and then I don't know how it came up, but you were like, what? You haven't seen that? And then I loved when you described the fact that getting, this is even further afield of Iron Man. I never even heard of the Guardians of the Galaxy comic book, which you were a fan of, and you said that immediately made you feel very connected because you're like, nobody really knew about this. They didn't have to make a movie of these characters, but they did, and they did it right. They put the music in there, which is great. The characters are very vivid. Yeah. The storyline was excellent. When I saw it here for the first time, I was stunned at how good it was, and I loved the second one even more.
Well, and it also what it allowed them to do is having had the Avengers end, well, the Avengers being like a sci-fi thing in a way with alien invasion.
Right.
And ending with Thanos at the very end of the movie, and you see that's where it comes from. Just you just saw his face, but if you're a comic book fan, you knew who it was.
Right.
You know, that's really cosmic Marvel stuff. It's sci-fi Marvel, not just superhero Marvel, you know, and there are characters who inhabit that sort of world, and they brought some of them in with Guardians of the Galaxy, and they'll be bringing more in with Captain Marvel, you know, the female version of it when that comes up.
Oh, that's kind of next. Yeah, you know? Yeah, this we talked about this, and I'll just bring it up for the listeners because we've had this conversation before. But I know you remember Secret Wars from the '80s. You remember Secret Wars?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Is there any parallels to that? I mean, I know that these Thanos, this Thanos character, the entire what's happening right now in this new film as well, that's already been played out in comic land. I mean, this story paralleling what people already know about
a version of this story, not this story exactly. There was a Infinity Gauntlet storyline. There have been several, but this is not it's what they've done that's kind of genius throughout these is they've taken these great ideas from the comics. Once they established the characters,
right.
They did take these great ideas from the comics, like the Winter Soldier, which is a great Captain America plot line, and they used it kind of in the movie Captain America the Winter Soldier, and the Civil War storyline, which is a big storyline in Marvel Comics. They took the basic idea of it, and they used that kind of in the Civil War movie.
Yeah, we talked about this before. That's what they used in the Batman films. They used the Dark Knight, what's-his-name's version of that.
Kind
the
of,
90s.
But all they
but
really
they
did out
really
of that was...
really do it.
But they didn't really do it. They kind of took the brooding character. But what they've really done is taken some of the... One of the things that comics have that are great that you know, is pretty good writing sometimes and great plots, great storylines. Comics have some great storylines. And one of the things I think where movies screwed up in the past was completely abandoning that or doing them in shitty ways.
Right.
And one of the things the Marvel people have done really well once they got started with their characters was they really went and took a few of these storylines, the Winter Soldier, so they could make a Captain America movie that was like a 70s thriller. That was the thing they did after they got all the characters established. Then they made a Captain America movie that was like a World War II movie, and that was okay. But then they made one that was like a 70s thriller, like 3 Days of the Condor, and that was great. That might be the best of all the movies. And then Civil War, they make one that's like they sort of get ready for their team up that's going to happen on Avengers Infinity War by doing a lot of that in Civil War. You know, the comedy kind of movies like they did with the Thor and Guardians of the Galaxy.
Right.
They've been willing to branch out to guys like Taika Waititi, the New Zealand director who directed Things We Do in the Shadows, which is if you haven't seen it, a fantastic movie about a bunch of vampires living in Auckland, kind of hanging out, having trouble getting into clubs because, as you know, according to myth, vampires have to be invited inside. So they go to the club, they show their IDs, but they can't go in unless they're invited in. And they keep trying to talk the guy at the doorway into inviting them in, and he's like, what do you want? Go in if you want to, you know? Could you just please invite us, you know? It's a bunch of modern, really ridiculous vampires. And that's a really funny movie. But then he followed it up with Hunt for the Wilder People, which is an absolutely heartbreakingly brilliant movie. I thought about this young kid who's a foster kid, gets fostered out to this elderly couple living kind of in the wilderness of New Zealand. And when some tragedies happen, you know, what he's faced with having finally kind of found a home for himself, what he's faced with having to deal with there. And it's very funny, but it's also very beautiful. And but to go find that guy and who's never made a Hollywood movie and have him make the Thor movie, Ragnarok, which is fantastic. It's really funny, great adventure movie, completely sets you up for Infinity Wars. You know, that's kind of risky, just like they did with Ryan Coogler, who had made Fruitvale Station and then made Creed. And they had him do Black Panther, which is an absolute triumph.
Well, you know? I think I guess you'd answer your own question when you say that. If Marvel controls the medium of film, and then they can couple that with what they're doing in comic books, it's almost like Stephen King being a great director. He's writing the story, but also he's respecting the story. If Marvel has to protect their characters, they don't want – a lot of times these big, huge companies get a character and they're like, okay, we got the character. People are just going to show up because they love Spider-Man. Let's just put a lot of explosions and special effects. There's no pathos. There's no underlying thing. That was what I loved about the Raimi films. He captured what we love about Spider-Man.
Yeah, he really did.
He absolutely did. Like the loser aspect, the love connection he has with Aunt May, the idea that he can't get, you know, he's in the middle of battling someone and he's late for a date. You know, he can't get a job, but he's Spider-Man. And all that stuff works on the Marvel level. So if Marvel controls it, then they're going to get... And the other thing I will say about Marvel, and I'll just use one example. Spider-Man was pretty much dying in the 80s, early 90s. And they just took a chance on Todd McFarlane, who ended up saving Spider-Man. And they didn't... Nobody knew who they... You know, they... I mean, obviously he had chops, but he only did the book for 4 or 5 issues, but it completely revitalized it. They gave his own, you know, Spider-Man title to it. Then, of course, he went on to bigger and better things with, you know, figurines and everything he's done. But...
Well, he had come from the indie comic world. He had done all the Spawn comics before.
Right, but here's the thing. They took a chance on him. They didn't have to put him... They didn't have to hand over Spider-Man to that guy. So I think that's great. That's Marvel... What I'm saying is it's the Marvel way, for lack
of
a better term.
Well, I think sort of...
To hand over something and then protect the characters. Make it quality instead of just making it.
Well, I think the thing they did was... You know, they had been licensing out for a while. You know, comic book companies didn't make movies. And they took a chance. And if you really look back on it, I mean, Iron Man is essentially an indie film. It's a low budget, especially compared to now. It's not a big budget movie. It's a fairly low to mid budget film. They hired Jon Favreau to direct it, who had, you know, not done a lot of stuff. I think he had done Jumanji before that, maybe. I can't remember. You know, not a guy who directed a ton of stuff. A comedy actor. Right. And writer.
Didn't he direct Swingers?
I think he did. Yeah, he did direct Swingers. Right. But I mean, Swingers, another
but
indie
nothing,
film.
Right. And the other thing, too, is Robert Downey Jr. was still kind, not quite Poison. I know he'd done Ally McBeal to get back into the business. But
no, Robert
people
Robert
weren't
was
handing
out of
things
movies.
Over.
He was out of movies until they hired him. You know, and he really made that work. And it's the perfect guy for it. He's brilliant at it.
He's kind of playing himself, you know, somebody who's got a damaged psyche who has to bring it back, but is obviously very bright and extremely confident in his talents the way he is as an actor.
But I also think that, like, they were, in a way, they were sort of lucky because there wasn't necessarily any market for that at all. Because of that, they just made the movie they wanted, a small movie about a character. And they made another one and another one and another one. And it wasn't for a little while before they really, you know... I'm not sure if any of us are really sure they were ever going to get to an Avengers movie at first.
Right.
But they did. They had a plan. And, you know, they started small. I mean, they were through, let's see, Iron Man, Iron Man 2, Thor, Captain America, and Hulk. They had 5 movies before they made the Avengers
movie.
At
least 5, because they had a couple of sequels thrown in there as well.
No, I think Iron Man 2 was the only one that was before the first Avengers movie. So I think they had 5 movies.
Oh, okay.
But 5 movies before you put all the characters together in a team-up movie, you know, that's a really great lead up. And then they could do, you know, this idea of phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, phase 4 that they've been going through, and, you know, expanding to characters like Doctor Strange, doing another Spider-Man movie that is completely, it's a joyride. It's a great, fun movie about a kid. He's very much a kid.
Oh, the last Spider-Man movie?
Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
it,
I like
he's
that
a
lot.
Kid. You know,
yeah.
He's got to be, you know, he's a freshman in high school in that movie, I think.
Right. Well, they took it back from the other two that were done after the Raimi films. And
yeah.
I didn't like the third Raimi film, and then I saw the first one.
Well, he didn't really do the third film. It was kind of taken away from him and
oh,
finished
he did?
By some
okay,
other.
Yeah.
You know, he had an idea for what he wanted to do. They sort of forced him to do a different plot line that he wasn't really ready for. I think it got rushed in because of the writer's strike, too. I can't remember if that's at the same time. And then it was sort of heavily edited. You know,
that
suffers
think
it from
didn't three
work.
Villain-itis.
Yeah,
that
they
that
haven't put
with
too
Batman
many people
too.
In
There's
it.
There's
you
too
know.
Many villains in that. Yeah.
But, you know, man, this movie... The luxury of having made, I think, at this point, 17 Marvel movies, I think is the number they were at
wow.
before this movie. And having made 17 movies and introduced all these characters so that they don't really have to introduce anyone except for Thanos, really. Everyone else has been introduced. We know everyone else in the movie. And it's just an endless pleasure of them hanging out, of groups of them hanging out that have never hung out together. Of, like, Iron Man and the Hulk meeting Doctor Strange, and then Spider-Man stumbling upon that, you know, that group of people. And then, you know, the Hulk who's just gotten back from space meeting, seeing Captain America again, and the Black Widow, and, and then meeting Black Panther and all that stuff. Or meanwhile, out in space, Thor floating along, you know, they're just the meeting the Guardians of the Galaxy. You can see that. I'm not giving any spoilers away. These are all in the commercials, these groups of people.
Sure.
I'm purposely picking groups of people that are in, you know, right. the commercials together so you can see that they're in the trailers, you know. Believe me, I'm not trying to ruin anything for anybody.
Oh, yeah, these are all in the trailers. Spoiler alert.
No, you know, it's just, they really, it's just pure pleasure because you have all this investment already.
Sure. And you don't have to waste a lot of time with backstories.
There's no backstories. Right. It just goes right into shit happening, and shit happens. And then for 2.5 hours, like, or more, I don't know how long it is, shit just seriously happens. Like, massive, intense shit.
Plus, they've been leading up to this. This Thanos character, we should say, for anyone who doesn't know anything about this stuff, is sort of an overarching villain that appears for just a few seconds in a couple of films. He's a major backstory villain in the Guardians of the Galaxy.
Well, yeah, but he first appears at the very end of Avengers, in the tag on Avengers. He appears there. And then, yeah, he's in the Guardians of the Galaxy movie.
Right.
You know, and there's developments throughout, but it...
But it's a build-up is what I'm trying to say. This villain has been building up over a series of films, so... Whatever, and I didn't see the film, but I'm just going to guess that whatever ends up happening is the result of this Thanos character plotting against or enacting his whatever villains enact has been a buildup all this time. This is not one of those things where they introduce a villain into a film and then they clash with the superheroes. This is something that's been building up over several years in many films.
Yeah, they've been setting up this fan for a long time. And then this movie starts, and they just throw an enormous amount of shit at it. And the shit goes everywhere. It's just, I don't know how else to put it. It was just really...
That's very good.
I've been stunned for days since then. I've been just stunned and like, yeah, I'm
well,
doing it now.
Of course you saw. I mean, I know you would see it because you're a huge fan and probably went the first night, if not the second
night. No, we went on Wednesday, a couple days ago.
It had been out
about
days,
5 or
right?
6 days. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, because the first few days were pretty full, and we also had all those theater tickets, so we went on Wednesday.
Did you see it in... How did you see it? Because I know you
Oh, IMAX 3D.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't really go... I mean, we show a lot of movies here at my house. I don't go to the theaters much except to see the IMAX 3D stuff, yeah. Really, these days. And to see Super Troopers. We did do that. That was... We had movie night a couple weeks ago, which was... last week at movie night, we did Thor Ragnarok to lead everybody into Infinity War. Right. And it was really funny again. I'm glad I waited to see it again until now. But 2 weeks ago, we did... I went out and bought tickets for... I found out who was coming, bought tickets for everyone to Super Troopers 2 around the corner.
Right.
And then we showed Super Troopers here, got up, walked around the corner to Super Trooper 2 and saw that. And then came home. That was our movie night.
Yeah,
I took everyone to the movies.
You had to miss it because you were invited to the premiere, right? But you couldn't make it because
I was so sick. And I felt really bad about missing that because everyone was here in town. And, you know, I was a part of the Kickstarter or the pledge drive they did for the movie. They had a telethon and we were on it. When we were writing songs, I think, for Somewhere Under Wonderland, they were doing that Kickstarter, and so Clifton was here with me, and we got on the couch and Skyped with the Kickstarter as a part of it.
That's cool.
As part of the pledge drive they did. The telethon, that's the word I was looking for.
Yeah.
Just know Jerry Lewis.
Ah.
I don't know. That movie, I have to say, Super Troopers 2 is so funny. It's hard to make a comedy sequel. They're often really cheap and stupid, and I love the original movie Super Troopers. I don't know how many times I've seen it. I love those guys because they're friends of mine, so I'm definitely biased. But that said, you know, because I know them all, you know, we made Freeloaders together. I spent a lot of time with those guys. It is possible for me to watch the movies and not have as much laughter because I see them. Man, I went to Super Troopers 2, and I was crying laughing during the movie. My stomach hurt by the end of the movie. There were moments where I couldn't stop, and it hurt so much. I was just laughing so hard. They really did a good job of it. You know, I was really proud of them when I saw it. And they knocked it out of the park, you know. And I had just read Jay's book, too.
Yeah, you mentioned it during
Mustache
one of the punk
Shenanigans.
Yeah.
We talked about that. Yep. And I love the book. But, you know, you forget when people are successful how hard it can be to make it through that, you know. Coming out of college to finally get a movie made and make Puddle Cruiser their first movie. To take it to Sundance and do so well. Have everyone really like it and all these audience responses. and for whatever reason, just never quite be able to sell it the way they wanted to for a theatrical release. I mean, I think it ended up going to DVD, or I don't know if On Demand existed then. Maybe it had a really brief theatrical release. You know, so when they come around again and they manage to raise the money and they make Super Troopers, on the one hand, it's pretty impressive that they've made another movie, but, like, are they going to be able to sell it? You know, and sure. They go to Sundance, and at first they take it to some other film festival first, which at the time, you weren't allowed to be in Sundance if you'd taken it somewhere else first. Sundance, I'm not sure if they still do that, but they had a rule.
Oh, they have exclusivity rights for that?
Not exclusivity necessarily, but you can't go anywhere first.
Ah.
They've been that way for a lot of movies. That's been a requirement, but I guess the movie had just... It had not gotten into Sundance at first, and it went somewhere else and showed it because they didn't get into Sundance. And then Sundance called back and said, you know, we're just really bummed. Why didn't you – we hear this movie's really great. Why didn't you have it here first? Now we can't have it. And they're like, well, we tried. You turned it down. And I guess the board was sort of like surprised. And they're like, well, let's see. And they worked around it. And they actually – there's a loophole there. They got to go to Sundance with Super Troopers, yeah. And it did so. But you go through these multiple screenings, and, you know, it's like we were talking about that other podcast. If – the audience response isn't right, or if the Q&A goes poorly, you know, and...
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah, those little cards they give to the audience. That was the old days where they would have the, you know, these premieres, and they would show the film, and then they would get, like, 62% negative, and they tell the guys, go back and recut the film.
No, that's not the old days. It's still done. We did it. We did it because it's really hard. with comedies, it's not the worst idea to just... because. It wasn't necessarily about the people's questions and their answers, although you get that too. It's like you put a camera in front facing the audience, though, a video camera in front to face the audience when you play the movie.
Oh, yeah, that's so terrible.
No, it's not the worst thing because then you just see when they laugh. If you're making a comedy, one thing you can't tell before you put it in front of an audience is where are people going to laugh.
That's true. I guess, that's the only way to tell if a comedy works.
Like you don't know whether it can be as simple as just editing a scene differently and getting a totally different response because you use a different... set of shots.
That's a good point because Rex Reed actually used to say that he only saw comedies with people. He never screened a comedy.
Right, and when you're editing and when you're watching by yourself in your screenings, it's really hard to tell. You can think it's really funny, but
of course, comedy.
How are those laughs going to fall on an audience? So we invited, you know, we had small audiences. I invited a lot of people I knew from Cal because it's the right age group. Back when we did it, we put a camera in front. The camera faces the audience, so. You don't get to be fooled by if you like a scene and you remember they laughed really hard. Well, you can always check the film. We'll see if they laugh really hard. You know, like it's to save you from yourself and your own biases in a way. You know, what works, what doesn't work. You don't have to go by all of it, but especially, I mean, I don't know if I would do that for a drama, but for a comedy, you know, you just don't know. And so, you know, we did that. I thought it made a big difference. We could tell some things that were really different about one cut and another cut, and we really saw places where things worked and where they didn't work, because we had some disagreements, you know, in the groups about what to do here, what to do there. There were some pretty basic disagreements about whether things worked, and put it in front of an audience, you could tell for sure whether they laugh. It's just as simple as that. There are other things, too, but you can certainly tell whether they laugh. I mean, there's a basic thing about, you know, also a questionnaire at the end about, did you like it? Did you like it, and would you recommend it to friends?
I was
going to
say, would you recommend it, yeah.
Did you like it, but you wouldn't? Or did you not like it, and you just wouldn't recommend it either? You know, that's worth knowing, just in general.
Do they have subtext to those questions? Like, you didn't like it, why?
Well, yeah, because you can have people talk. They'll fill out the cards, but you also invite questions from the audience, too, and you'll have talk back that you can hear. Because, you know, it's worth checking out. Just sort of a basic things. To me, the laughs were more important, but... as you might guess, the laughs go along with the I like it and I'd recommend it.
Right.
You know, the lack of laughs don't, quite simply. You know, it's comes
yeah,
up...
That was very difficult. I went to one of those one time in New York for Tim Burton's Sleepy Hollow. My wife and I just somehow, through some connection, they were looking for people to come see the film and give their opinion and for, you know, in its... I think it was... wasn't in its nascent stage. I think it was at least... right before they released it, but they still had time to make cuts in. And it was, while I'm watching it, I felt this weird sort of, maybe it's the writer in me, but this pressure of, I should be really watching this movie and form an opinion, rather than just let the movie wash over me. I knew I was going to be judging it. people were going to ask my honest opinion, and I didn't just want to. And the funny thing is, I couldn't conjure up anything to say about. I mean, I like that movie. I think it's good. You know, I loved Christopher Walker, and I'm a huge fan of Johnny Depp. Christina Ricci, I think, is in that movie. I thought that movie was fine. You know, it's not exactly the original concept from Washington Irving, but I thought it was a good Hollywood film. I had nothing to say. It was weird. I think I would have had more to say if people didn't say, all right, you're ready. Watch the film. When it's over, we're going to know. We would like to know what you think. It's a lot of pressure to put on people. But you know what? Laughter is different. Something's funny or it's not to you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's when you see a drama, you're like, okay, I was moved. Or you see a horror film, I was creeped out a little bit. But with a comedy, you're just sitting there and either you laugh or you don't. And this is, we talked about this in one of our earlier podcasts. With your friend, stand-up comedy is the ultimate tightrope walk because not only are you – I mean, it's live, so they're not laughing. You're dying up there. But you're either going to find something funny or you don't. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. If we could get back for just a second what you said, I think is very important. And you and I have talked about this again when we were working on the book. I don't know how we got onto it. But about how Annie Hall, the Woody Allen masterpiece, was the only only comedy to win Best Picture. Or to be considered. And then we always talk about how The Simpsons never, and I know it's an animation, but it never got nominated for an actual, you know, it always has to be animated Emmy or a comedy Emmy. There's like certain genres where comedy's kind of pigeonholed in there and they can't get out from under it. For a while it was that way with the horror film genre until Silence of the Lambs won Best Picture. It's really unfair.
I agree. There's got to be some, though, aren't there? That's some that like...
I can't think of any that have won Best Picture. There are some that have that people have won Best Actress or Actor for. Talk about the Spencer Tracy films, like you said, with Katharine Hepburn. Or what are some of the other ones that people won? Sidney Poitier winning for Who's Coming to Dinner. That was like a comedy.
That's not a comedy, though. It's a romance, but it's really not a comedy.
Right, but it was not, I mean... yeah, so I'm trying to think of something, you know, and now we're going back, of course. But normally it's the drama, it's the interesting style movie, it's the movie about, you know, damaged personalities or the historical biopic that gets the attention from critics.
Well, It Happened One Night wins.
How far is
1934.
That? 1934.
That's a comedy, for sure.
Oh, yeah, it's what you were talking about. It's a classic.
You Can't Take It With You, sort of a comedy. In the 30s. I'm trying to look for other ones here. Yeah, I mean, we do like to pat ourselves on the back and give... We're also serious and intellectual. We often do that with movies.
And we do, too, you and I. I mean, look, it's hard, and you and I have had this discussion before. I thought Raging Bull should win over Ordinary People. We both love Ordinary People. That was something that meant something to you. And then it wins. But no matter which way you pick it, it's like arguing Jordan versus LeBron James or something. It's like if you pick Jordan, you're ripping LeBron James. I'm not ripping the fact that Ordinary People won. I was not a big fan of Gandhi winning over, say, E.T., which is a lighter film. But to me, E.T. is its generation's Wizard of Oz. And that transported me back to being a kid again. Not that I was, you know, I was in my 20s. But I couldn't wait to bring people to see E.T. It really was just so... And then Gandhi's great, and I'm a huge fan of that story, and he's one of the great historical figures of the 20th century, and Ben Kingsley's masterful, and the movie's an epic, and I just don't think it's as better from film than E.T. So, you know, but E.T.'s never going to win over Gandhi. It's just not going to happen, and it's very rare, which is why when Rocky beat out, like, All the President's Men, people were stunned, because they kind of feel like Rocky was kind of a goofy, comic booky version of, hey, you know, they've done a million films like that. The Palooka who wins over the... But I think it was fantastic that won, because it just shows that every once in a while some small film, like Shakespeare in Love, that's a comedy, that won.
Well, there's the Sting one, a few years before Rocky, the Sting one.
That's a masterpiece of storytelling, though.
Yeah,
I'm not really
it's
sure.
It's a very, very, but it's a comedy, for sure.
It is, you're right. It's a buddy comedy.
I mean, that year that Rocky won, every movie in there holds up, though. All the President's Men, Bound for Glory is great, though people don't see it as much anymore. Network, really brilliant.
Oh,
and
Network.
Taxi Driver. Taxi Driver's
wow,
that same year.
Wow, what a lineup. Yeah, I think out of all those films, I will have to say Network has held up the longest. If you have a chance to go see Network, it's Paddy Chayefsky screenplay. It really does mirror what's going on right now in media and the United States. Yeah, it's the one film that presages everything else. I guess All the President's Men, you could make that point too. But wow, Taxi Driver, again, one of the great American
Well, the year that Annie Hall won, it beat out The Goodbye Girl, which is a Neil Simon
Yes, his comedy. Best film.
I Julia, think. Which is a great movie about a...
That's right.
It's Julia is played by, what is her name? Brilliant British actress. Her daughters, Julie Richardson and Natasha Richardson. But it's about her friendship with Dashiell Hammett and Lillian Hellman, who are played by Jason Robards and Jane Fonda. That's another movie that year. The Turning Point, which is a great movie. The Herb Ross movie about the ballet.
That's right.
With Shirley MacLaine and Anne Bancroft.
Anne Bancroft.
Shirley MacLaine. And also right. And Mikhail Baryshnikov. But also, the fifth movie that year.
Vanessa Redgrave. Really
the fifth movie that year is the one that really should have won.
Which one?
Star Wars.
Ah, ha, ha.
You know, in its own way, more influential than anything else.
Anything.
There. And,
it changed Hollywood. It changed filmmaking.
Forever, yeah.
It saved the genre. Science fiction was nowhere. The two most correct me if I'm wrong. The two most important science fiction films of our lifetimes, 2001: A Space Odyssey, which you could not make Star Wars without that.
Yeah.
And Star Wars. Those two films changed everything, and neither one of them, I think, got much accolade. Nobody went to see 2001, by the way, which is now considered one of the top 10 films ever made. The film completely bombed. If it wasn't for stoners, no one would ever see that movie. In fact, after a while, they started to promote it to people to get high and go to that film.
Well, it's more fun if you're high.
That's right, kids. Wow, that's it. You know what my favorite lineup is, though? Look it up. 75, the year that One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest won.
Barry Lyndon. Barry Lyndon's okay. Dog Day Afternoon's great.
Jaws.
Nashville and Jaws, yeah.
And you'd have to probably give Jaws. Nashville's a masterpiece. Jaws is my favorite Spielberg movie. What was the other one?
Dog Day Afternoon.
Oh.
Barry Lyndon's not a great Kubrick movie, but it's a great movie, I guess. But
What's the thing about Barry Lyndon that sets it apart from every other movie? From
most expensive costume movie ever. It was the most expensive movie ever at the time, wasn't it?
The whole film was shot at actual light. They used no lighting in that film.
Oh, wow.
Because they wanted to make it, so they lit like hundreds. They almost burned down a couple of sets. They lit like hundreds of candles to get certain light and shadows in that. Once I knew that, when I saw that film, changed my whole aspect of the film.
That's like watching. Have you ever seen Days of Heaven?
The uncut one.
What'd you say?
The uncut version of Days of Heaven.
It was shot entirely at magic hour. He only shot it at dawn and dusk. There's no. They would sit around all
day. Right.
They would shoot for 20 minutes or something at magic hour, and then they would. They would shut down, and they would get up early in the morning
do
it again.
Who did that? Who did it? Is that a Cimino film?
No, it's the guy who did... what's the movie? Badlands. He just started making movies again after all these years. He hasn't been doing movies for a while.
Days of Heaven?
It's going to drive me crazy that I can't remember his name. What is Badlands...
That's a 78 film. Terrence Malick.
Terrence Malick, right. He didn't make many. He made Badlands, which is brilliant. It's the movie with Sissy Spacek and Martin Sheen about the guy that Nebraska's about, Charlie Starkweather. It's kind of about that. It's a retelling of that story.
Yes,
to a couple that goes on a killing spree.
Yep.
And then he made Days of Heaven, and I think he didn't make anything for the longest time. And then he made movies, started making movies about 10 or 15 years ago again.
That was 1978. Amazingly. What was the... You sent me that clip, the Lawyers, Guns, and Money. What was that from? What film? That looks like a Western. You sent me a clip last night.
Oh, it was a TV show called Longmire. I was watching... I just was like sitting around yesterday afternoon watching it, like a few episodes of it on Netflix. And the scene goes by. They're searching under the bed, and they pull these two suitcases out from under the bed, and the other cop opens one up. It's full of money. He opens one up. It's clearly housed AK-47s, and they're not there anymore. And he goes, well, we got guns and money now. We just need lawyers. And then it cuts to commercial.
Thank you.
I was like, wow. I immediately rewound it, filmed it, and sent it to James.
Thank you very much. That was well. And I actually was playing it on guitar because did you see that clip I sent you of T-Bone playing with Warren? T-Bone's got to be in his 20s then. Maybe not. Maybe it was 1984. Warren Zevon and T-Bone Burnett playing acoustic guitars, playing Lawyers, Guns, and Money in C. I've always played it in D since I was like in bands. And I have a little higher voice, obviously, all of us do, than Warren. But I found it really fascinating. So I kept rewinding and rewinding. And then I said, well, I got to send it to Adam because, you know, T-Bone. But it's great because
I didn't see that. I didn't know what you were talking about when you said T-Bone.
I think I emailed it to you. I might have emailed it to you because the interesting thing is, first of all, T-Bone's like 6 foot and Warren's like a little taller than me. But you could see that he's clearly like really nervous. He's looking at Warren's head. And Warren is, if not three sheets on his way. It's a great clip. But yeah, that's what it reminds me of. And I started, was playing around with it last night, and then I got that clip. So the name of, what is the name of that show?
Longmire.
Longmire. Is that any good? Any good?
Yeah, it's pretty fun. I don't know. I was just watching in the afternoon. I enjoyed it. Then we went to see Michaela Davis play last night. She played like a little private show for her managers and for some record company stuff.
We mentioned her in the previous podcast. Yeah. That's her playing the harp, right?
She played it at pianos, and man, it was unreal. Her, first of all, her bands up there on stage are the bass player. They both, the bass player and the guitar player, look like they're in Big Star. They have long, like great long hair. The bass player is wearing a Big Star T-shirt.
No kidding.
Which, I mean, I'm always like, that's enough to get me. You get love from me for that right there off the bat.
Same guitar player that was playing with the bow in the film and the video that you showed?
I think so.
Yeah.
That was like 4 or 5 years ago, though. Now they're like, they had this really kind of funky psychedelia thing going on, and they had some real country to them. And she's written like a bunch of songs, and the songs were so much better. Like, she's just written great songs. Like, I liked the songs I saw, and I was blown away by their performance in the first stuff I watched. But seeing them yesterday, you know, she had sent me a couple songs from her new record. After the show, I just said, do you have the record done? She said, yeah. I'm like, I gotta have it. You just gotta send me the whole record now. I gotta hear it. They have some great songs. There's a lot of three-part harmonies. They were killing it. It was so good. It just knocked me out. Once you didn't like play at 6:30 last night, early. Like, just from 6:30 to maybe 7:30.
That's right, because I got a text from you like 10 to 8 or something. You sent me a couple of clips of it. I was like, where is he?
Buddy? She started playing, and I started flipping out right away. I started immediately, like, videoing chunks of songs.
That's a nice video.
And sending them to all of my partners in Underwater Sunshine, because we got a playing for us. And so, like, I'm like, you guys are not going to believe how good this band is. Because we booked her on the strength of stuff she did 3 or 4 years ago. I just hadn't heard new stuff.
And, of course, I see these clips, and I immediately start texting you, can we get her on the podcast?
Yeah.
Can we,
yeah. Well, they were leaving. They started a tour today. But, man, like, as soon as they started, I was just like, holy shit. I just started videotaping it, sending it to all my partners, like, check this shit out. I sent it to Immer, and then I sent it to you. I'm like, you guys have got to see this stuff.
It's visually stunning to watch her, because you don't get that visual of her playing. She's playing the harp. It's so beautiful, and she's doing rhythms with it. But she's singing. The microphone's right next to her. It's the coolest visual, you know?
Yeah, it looks different. The furniture on stage is different than anything you've ever seen.
And she's the lead singer, so your eyes immediately go to her.
So, I was giving the drummer shit because he's completely blocked. When I talked to the drummer afterwards, I was giving him shit. I'm like, well, it's nice to meet you. I couldn't see you at all. I can hear you. You played great. I couldn't see you. And by the way, you sang great, because I knew it was him singing because no one else was near mic. I could kind of see him leaning over through the strings of the harp. You know?
It's kind of hard when you have a giant instrument up there blocking everyone. Yeah. Well, that's really fantastic.
They'll be here at the Underwater Sunshine Festival.
You got to come, people. That's going to be the shit. Do you have a room for that yet? Do you have a
yeah, it'll
venue?
Be at Bowery Electric. Yeah.
That is a great room. And now, are we all set with the grouping, or this is still an organic? It's still, you guys still booking? You're still looking? There's a lot of stuff going on with that?
Well, we've booked most of the bands now. We still have a couple slots we're waiting to hear from. But, you know, we're almost all the way there now.
How many total do we have?
16 or 17, maybe?
Nice.
I think that's how many slots there are. And then, of course, there'll be twice that many playing here, doing the garden shows.
Right.
Let's see if this is a lineup. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Yeah, I think it's 17 bands altogether.
That's a nice... That's over two nights?
Yeah.
Both stages again?
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Upstairs and downstairs.
Yeah, I mean, if you're listening to this and you're not in New York and you're planning on a little trip, you got to come see this thing. It's so cool.
What were we talking about before all this?
We were talking about films, and films that don't win Best Pictures and ones that do, and then we were going over the lists of of best pictures, and specifically, I think in the 70s, I feel like the golden age of film, especially after the demise, as they say in England, of the studio structure, like the independent auteur filmmakers that started with Easy Rider. David Biskind wrote a book called Easy Riders and Raging Bulls, and he talks
about the 70s. You're talking about the 70s.
The 1970s.
But
yes.
Beginning with 69 with Easy Rider.
68, 69. Well, I kind of put, because I just did a piece on the 50th anniversary of The Graduate, my favorite film. And in there, you know, in the piece I wrote about, and I've interviewed a few people too, including a woman that wrote a book about it recently, is that that film was one of the first independent films. They got no money from anybody. They totally winged that. And they got Nichols for nothing, and they, you know, nobody knew who Dustin Hoffman was. Anne Bancroft took very little money for it. She was a stage actor at the time. They guerrilla shot all that stuff in Berkeley, or, you know, say. So that's kind of, I mean, even though it just kind of falls under the radar, they kind of consider Easy Rider to be the first. Easy Rider and Bonnie and Clyde to be the first two films completely outside of the
70s, even though they're in the 60s.
Right, and they begin that whole period in which even the big filmmakers, like Spielberg, comes out of this whole Spielberg...
Coppola.
Coppola, Scorsese...
Film school grads.
Film school grads, right. And then I'm missing our man from Star Wars.
George Lucas.
Lucas. Right.
And guys like Michael Cimino, who was for a minute there with Deer Hunter, the guy, until he made Gates of Heaven, which crashed.
Right.
Is it MGM Studios or United Artists? I can't remember which one got...
United Artists, I think.
You know, crashed it by Gates of Heaven.
Gates of Heaven, right.
Is it Gates of Heaven? What's the name of that movie?
Heaven's Gate.
Heaven's Gate, right. Yeah. Gates of Heaven is the documentary about pet cemeteries.
Oh, yes, very good.
The guy that did... Vernon, Florida, and The Thin Blue Line. What is his name? Vernon, Florida, The Thin Blue Line.
I don't remember. We just should throw props out to Midnight Cowboy, which got an X rating and won Best Picture that year, which came out in 69. And Hoffman took that role before he became famous.
Errol Morris. That's the guy I'm thinking of. Who? Errol Morris is the documentary director who directed The Thin Blue Line, directed Vernon, Florida, and he directed Gates of Heaven.
Right.
Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's right. I was going to say that George Lucas and Scorsese both worked on Woodstock. They were up in Woodstock. They did sound and film for Woodstock. And they met all their independent... Schumacher, I believe her name is, that edited all the...
Thelma Schoonmaker.
Schumacher. She was an editor.
All of Scorsese's stuff she did.
Yes, and she was an editor. That's how he met her on Woodstock, which is a groundbreaking film. You know...
If not a particularly great one.
It's not a particularly great one. It's not a great concert film.
No, it's not at all. It's nothing on like Monterey Pop.
No.
The year before, that is a fantastic movie. Probably the first movie where everyone's dead.
Everyone's dead. That's Mama
That
Cass.
Movie has more people in it that died. Festival.
Jimi Hendrix, Mama Cass, there's Brian Jones walking around. They keep showing him in the film. He's dead. Or he died shortly after that.
Keith Moon. Let's go through Scott McKenzie, the Mamas and the Papas, so Mama Cass died. Can't Heat, I Don't Know. And Simon and Garfunkel, Hugh Masekela, Jefferson Airplane, Marty Balin, now dead, but
right.
I don't know about then. Then Janis Joplin, Big Brother and the Holding Company.
That's correct.
Eric Bird and the Animals, no. The Who.
Right, we said Keith Moon.
Keith Moon
and
died.
And John Entwistle's dead, but that's
Otis
after.
Redding.
Otis Redding.
After that, Jimi Hendrix, and then the Mamas and the Papas played.
Yeah, Otis Redding's performance at Monterey Pop. Yeah, I would say, but that was Pennybacker. D.A. Pennybacker made that film, and he, of course, made Don't Look Back, which is, I think, the finest portrait of an artist on film that I've ever seen. Dylan is doing his usual act in that, but there are moments in there, we talked about when he's playing with Donovan in the room, and he's clearly drunk. Or that time where he comes up, someone throws a bottle onto the street, and then the people come up from the hotel, and they're like, hey, come on. And there's a lot of yelling, and of course there's a lot of young, drunk people going, you can't tell us what to do. And Dylan is like the peacemaker. That's a great film. That's a Pennybacker film as well, who did Monterey Pop.
He also did Eat the Document, the Dylan film after that.
That's right, with Lennon
in
it.
And he did the Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars.
That's right.
And he made that great movie about... The Clinton, The War Room.
Oh, The War Room. That's a great film. He did War Room. That's right. I will say that the Ziggy one is not lit well. I know that's was the staging, but they didn't really. It wasn't like The Last Waltz where Scorsese blasted the thing with lights so you could see everybody playing. But I'm always partial to Gimme Shelter because of the historical aspect of it. The concert footage in there is not fantastic, although it's our only glimpse of the Stones when they become the greatest rock and roll band in the world. First tour ever with monitors, I think.
Where the band
can actually hear themselves.
What he did that's really great that I don't think most people have even ever seen. At one point, PBS was going to make a new series called Original Cast Album. That was the name of the TV show they were going to do. They're going to make the series. You know, at the time, Broadway at the center of our culture in a lot of ways, and they're going to make a show called Original Cast Album. And they shoot a pilot for it with D.A. Pennebaker. And it's for the play Company, which is the groundbreaking Stephen Sondheim play about relationships, marriage, and it's all its failure, marriage and relationships and sex in America, which Broadway, which is a very staid place, suddenly to have a film about people getting divorced and people having sex and people lying to each other and cheating on each other and the general failure of the drunken failure of the American relationship,
right?
The American marriage
to song.
Yeah, it's an amazing play about life in New York, and but the idea for this is they would, you know, cast albums get made, the cast usually goes in the studio, it's all done in one day. Cast albums are usually done in one day, you know, and you'd have they'd capture these people doing it. And the first one was the cast of Company, which is, you know, Dean Jones, who at the time was a huge star from being in every Walt Disney movie. There were only two guys who were the leads in Walt Disney movies back then. It was Kurt Russell and Dean Jones. Russell, all through the 60s and early 70s.
Yep.
All the Herbie movies or the
Herbie,
Dean Jones ones.
The Love Bug.
The Kurt Russell one, the strongest man in the world, the fastest man in the world.
Yeah. The world's greatest athlete.
World's greatest athlete. The world's the computer in tennis shoes. The computer wore tennis shoes.
That's
right.
I saw all those movies.
Yeah, sure, me too.
Those are the only movies you could see as a kid. We didn't have the spate of like 15 animated movies that come out every summer for kids to go to. I mean, those were Disney was it. That was our shot.
So it's Dean Jones, but also in the cast is Elaine Stritch, who's a huge Broadway star for, you know, 40, 50 years, and a brilliant singer, but a drinker for sure. And her big numbers are going to be at the end of the day. And like, they've all been in there all day, and like, it's really kind of cool because you've got Sondheim and all these singers, and he's directing them through these very, very difficult songs. A lot of these songs are truly difficult to sing, and he's like, you know, this one song I can't really. It's I'm Not Getting Married Today, and it's about a million miles an hour. It's like so fast. And at one point, Sondheim's like, "No, it's not. It's." You missed. You're a half step off on that one note, and you're like, "Wow, do people actually correct people on that?" I guess you do. If you're Sondheim and you're writing it this way, you want them to sing it that way. Sure. I don't care how fast it is, get it right. You know, it's pretty brilliant to watch it. And at the end of the day, though, they get there, and Elaine Stritch is singing, but she's kind of, I think, been drinking all day. That's what's sort of insinuated. It seems, I'm not sure, and she's tired too. And it's the song. There's one other one, and then the Ladies Who Lunch is her big number about it's the absolutely just eviscerates upper class, you know, women in society, the Ladies Who Lunch. It is, and she delivers it, and it's awesome. And they all sit around, they're like, "I don't know." And she's like, "Well, I don't know, I really have my full voice." And I'm thinking, what? I mean, that was amazing.
Right.
And she's like, "I don't know." And then they have a little appendage because it wasn't going to all be that one day. And they come back the next day and they do it again. They arrange for her to come in the next morning and do it again.
Right.
And she comes in and it's amazing. Like, it is better, which I wouldn't have conceived of at the time. But she does. She does it better. It's amazing, you know. And there's, you can get it on DVD. It's just called Original Cast Album Company. They did it. They shot it. And then PBS decided not to make a show. So they have this one document ever made. And then the first one was shot by D.A. Pennebaker. You know, it's D.A. So you got D.A. Pennebaker, Dean Jones, Elaine Stritch, and Stephen Sondheim. You know,
it's
all doing his cast album
behind
in 1971,
you know. That's really cool.
So it is. It's like all of them in a recording studio one day with the orchestra, by the way. This isn't just singers. It's the orchestra, too.
Okay, so that's what I was going to ask you, because I was always in the impression when they did cast albums that they would record the orchestra. get the backing tracks done, like you would do with anything, and then the cast would come up and sing. And if you were singing with someone else, it was a duet or a part where they're using song to have an argument or whatever they're doing. They would sing it. Otherwise, they'd just put you in a booth like they would do for any singer, Sinatra, you, anybody, and then you'd sing it. That's not the case. They were singing live with the live, like they would do
it
on stage.
I don't know if I'm remembering it wrong, but I remember the orchestra being there too.
Maybe they just did it for the show. I mean, for the PBS.
I don't know, but you got to remember, this is that back then.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say is I'm wondering if all those cast albums, like, you know, Funny Girl or My Fair Lady that I heard when I was a kid, my parents used to play.
I'm guessing back then a lot of them were done with the orchestra and the singers right there. And you were just expected to get it.
Right.
You weren't going to be doing 50 takes because they only have the orchestra, you know, you have these.
Oh, yeah, they're on
union time. Oh, you know? Yeah. And maybe they do get the orchestra in one of them and they date you afterwards. But, you know, back then also you've been doing this eight shows a week.
Yes.
So you're expected to kind of know your shit at that point.
Right.
And also you don't have a lot of time because guess what you have to do the next day?
You have to be on the show.
A show. Yeah. You know, like, I mean, this is probably on your eight shows. It's probably done Sunday night or Monday. Mm-hmm. You know, that's it. And Tuesday you're back on stage again. So I would assume it's all done there at the same time.
Sure.
But I don't know for sure. But I think that's what it is, at least on this one.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that people don't know, maybe they do, I don't know. But when I was a kid, one of my favorite things was the Jesus Christ Superstar album, which was done as an album. They never, ever conceived, Andrew Lloyd Webber or, you know, Rice had never conceived of that being a play.
Had the lead singer for Deep Purple doing
this. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was a rock album, and they just wanted to do a concept rock album. You know, they were inspired by Tommy, and they wanted to do – and they were going, okay – they love the idea that it's Tommy, but Pete Townsend is not. We are. This is what we do. Let's do one. Let's show them how it's done. But then later on that they staged it, so they had to come up with staging. But I'm trying to think of other ones that did that. I mean, obviously they did Tommy. They staged Tommy, in the 90s here in Broadway? But, I mean,
that was much, much later, though. That was made into a play.
But Townsend never considered that. I'm trying to think of another play that someone used. It's almost like when you make a film, you don't have money, so you make like a trailer first with whatever money you have and try to get people to give you money to make the full
film. Which is what they did for Deadpool. Not a trailer, but they had this. Did you see Deadpool?
I never have.
Okay, well, I don't know, for people out there, there's a scene where he's sitting on the freeway exit and he's about to jump off the overpass and he jumps into a car and he starts ninjaing everyone to shit. And what it was is Ryan Reynolds had been trying to make this movie forever. And these guys made a kind of a CGI version of Deadpool that he jumps into this car and does this stuff. And they used his voice for it. And it's just that one scene that you see in the movie now. I don't know if they redid it. I assume they did. But he's sitting on an overpass and then he's like talking to himself in his nonsensical way. And then he just sort of jumps off into the car, kills everybody. And that's the end of the thing, you know? And it was just that scene. And they used Ryan Reynolds' voice for it. And that's how they sold everyone on the eye. Then they just leaked it onto the internet. And it's like, it's a great scene. And everyone was like, this could be great.
Yeah, yeah.
We should. And then Tim Miller and Ryan Reynolds got the money to make the movie.
Yeah, I remember my brief and painful foray into screenplay writing was inspired by a good friend of mine, Carl Pagano, who's a filmmaker. And he's done a few shorts. And he mostly does professional work now. But he had wanted to do a horror film short. He just needed a script for it, and he's not a writer, so I did something for him, and then we expanded it out into something else. Anyway, he was inspired by Blood Simple. You know the Coen brothers? Yeah, sure. They put together their first film, Blood Simple, which I think is Frances McDormand's first film because she's married to one of those guys. Anyway, yeah. they made a mini 8-minute film and got money to make a film. That's how they did it. So that's what he wanted to do. He was inspired by that. So have you ever seen the 8-minute Blood Simple? It's...
No, but I remember seeing that movie in the theaters. And there's a whole... Isn't there a scene in Blood Simple where the car crashes and it's they're filmed...
upside down?
Upside down.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a really funny thing on the Criterion of that movie where they have the whole directors and producers, you know, commentary.
Commentary, yeah.
And they do this whole commentary about how the way they shot that was... they didn't put the car upside down. They put the entire crew and everything upside down. That all of this filmmakers were upside down for that. They do this whole... It's complete bullshit, I think. I think that's what I'm remembering. I remember watching it with Henry when that Criterion first came out. Henry, my Red Griffin, my old roommate. And I think I remember him telling... You know, watching it together, and that was the thing. They were just doing this complete... It's complete bullshit. It's like a play on the commentary that, like, rather than do the car upside down, they shot the entire crew upside down. Everyone filming is upside down, and the people in the car are not. And I can't remember, though. I've been going through all the shit around my house. I gave you a bunch of posters when you got here today.
Thank you.
Old Counting Crows stuff. And I actually really took cool. pictures of everything and sent them to the band first to say, do you guys want anything? But I also found everything else, went over all the stuff, all the artwork in my house that I want to put up on the walls that I've been waiting around for years to do, and took it all down to this place to get framed. And one of the things, I found these three posters by Jason Munn. I think they were part of a Rolling Roadshow series he did when, you know, the Alamo Drafthouse, they used to do these things called Rolling Roadshows, and they have this huge movable movie screen, like a drive-in movie screen, but it's inflatable, it's huge. And they will go to places, like they'll go to Monument Valley, and they'll show The Searchers, or She Wore a Yellow Ribbon in Monument Valley.
Nice.
Or they take it to Mount Rushmore, and they'll show North by Northwest in front of Mount Rushmore.
That's like a great idea.
This big screen. And they go to all these places and do this stuff. And he did one of the years they did it, Jason Munn, who's a poster artist and does a lot of art for bands too, is brilliant. Which makes me think, why didn't I ever ask him to do it for us? Maybe I'm going to call it, get up, ask after this, because he'd be so good.
Call an old Jason.
He did these three posters. Well, he did a series about seven, but I have three of them because they're really rare and they're hard to get. Mondo Posters Online does these things sometimes. I don't know if they still do them. They did them for years. Like they release these movie posters and they'll just say they're going to be available at 9 o'clock. Tomorrow morning or now. They'll just put it on their Twitter and they'll say now.
The original movie posters or like prints?
Well, no, they're these new ones that are done, but they're for new movies. Like I've won a couple where I got there in time to get them.
Oh, it's
they're
a
limited editions
thing?
What?
You have to bid on it?
No, they're one price, but they're limited editions. There's only, say, 100 of them.
Oh, so you have to order it now.
You have to order it. And then, like, I got a couple Captain America ones that are really cool that Ollie Moss did. I got a Dark Knight Rises that Ollie Moss did. Ollie Moss did, I think, a Rolling Roadshow series at one point, and I got the Godfather 2, and it's really cool. It's like, it says Janko Importing. It's like an olive oil can, and the Godfather stuff's on there, and there's one for Convoy that's a really great. Ollie Moss is a very sort of Saul Bass-influenced poster artist. He does some great stuff. He did this one for Convoy, this one for Rocky that's amazing. It's a beautiful poster.
So it's not from the period. It's a completely new concept.
Yeah, they're new.
Based
some of
on
them
the
are
film.
From – but I think he also, like, one of his Rolling Roadshow posters is the poster for There Will Be Blood. He did the movie poster for that.
Oh,
and that
wow.
is one of his Rolling Roadshow ones as well. It's, like, in the series – I don't have that one, but when I've seen it, it looks exactly like the film poster to me, so I wonder if that's just his design.
Right.
But I found these three that Jason Munn did. One of them is for No Country for Old Men, and it's just really incredible. It's like a quarter flipping in the air, but it flips in the shape of a question mark.
Nice.
Then there's one for Blood Simple. What is it? And the third one is The Searchers, which is really cool. But the Blood Simple one, it's this it's very beautiful graphic of just like this cornfield or a field. It's like three quarters of the poster is taken up by like a plowed field with like lines in it, and right at the top is a car parked, and then there's a line of blood from the car, just a thin red line that goes from the car to one of the furrows in the field. So it has a red line down one of the plowed lines.
I think I've seen that.
It is the most incredible poster.
That's great.
I could probably just find it for you on here. I looked it up online the other day, though, like trying to find it, what they look like. Here, Jason.
That's cool. Munn. Yeah, I just want to say, I want to chime in because I don't want to forget. I think that the original movie poster for Rocky, where you see the silhouette of him and Adrian walking with their backs, they're walking away, and he's clearly he's in his boxing regalia shorts, and she and I always thought that was really – that's fantastic.
Isn't that
wow.
a cool poster? It's not a car. It's a guy walking at the
yes,
top.
Yeah.
With a shovel because he's just tried to bury someone, remember? And the guy crawls away down the field. It's
yes.
Dan Hedaya's character.
Yeah, it's really cool. I mean, that's a great amazing movie, people. Go watch that movie.
I found those posters. That one and
– that looks like Hopper painting.
Yeah, it's a really – he does some incredible stuff. I took these all into the framing shop the other day to get them framed.
That's nice.
And I was really excited. When I really started realizing like – oh, these cool things I have. They're really great.
Yeah, you
movie
should
posters.
Put them up. Yeah. You could put them in the movie room, except for you have no room because you just got movies everywhere.
Well, the entry hall to the movie room is where I have most of my movies.
That's right.
But I'm going to do some out here. I'm taking a lot of the stuff here down.
Oh, so. What's that really cool poster? You showed me. Didn't you have like a German or...
They're Polish. I have a lot
Polish
of
Polish graduate poster.
Yeah, the graduate poster. It's
yeah,
amazing.
Yeah, you showed it to me. That's right. That's really cool. Well, I want to get back to the Rocky one for a second. But the reason why I love that poster, that movie, one of my favorite movie posters, and I love Rocky, but is because it's really, that's a film about love. It's a love story, right? It's a guy... Going, I mean, the salvation of that character is Adrian, you know?
Yeah.
And he's her salvation. And I think one of the greatest endings of any film is he loses, but the music is swelling. And they're showing you shots of the guy, and the winner is Apollo Creed. And he doesn't care. He's like Adrian. He's like looking for her. And I know they've mocked it and parodied it forever. When I first saw that, though, I was stunned at how great an idea that, because I hate endings. I hate them most times. That's one of the great endings. So when I saw that movie poster years later, I thought, well, yeah, of course. That's what that film's about. It's not a film about boxing. It's a film about love. You know, and self-determination or self-belief. And then, you know, supporting someone else. You know, he's trapped in his world. She's trapped in, you know, it's been done a million times, but I thought they did it beautifully. And I think that's what separates that film from other sports films.
Here's the Ali Moss Rocky poster.
Let me see. Oh, that's nice.
Isn't that a great poster?
You know what it is? The color.
But I love how it's
like an orange with...
His shadow turns into the steps that he's running up.
Yeah, to just describe it for you, because, you know, we're this is a audio medium we're talking to you on. It's like a dark... Looks like the shadow of someone with their arms in the air, but the silhouette... Not the silhouette, but his legs from his waist down are stairs, and he's running up the stairs like the famous stairs he runs up in Philly. But this... You could, you know what this is? This is Vertigo, the Vertigo poster.
Vertigo is Saul Bass.
Saul Bass's thing.
Yeah, I mean that's what I'm saying. Ali Moss is a really brilliant artist, but he's very Saul Bass influenced.
So he just pick films to do? Did he do, you know, other stuff like Jaws or, you know, did he do?
I'll show you some other Ali Moss.
Are we gonna make it through this whole podcast without playing music? This could be a first.
Well, we could play some music. I have been flipping out. Lately, I've been going through all this Miles Davis Live stuff that I got. I got the bootleg series by him that was really cool, and I got I have a bunch of live Ella Fitzgerald stuff that I had never really like sat down and really gone through and listened to, and I loaded it all in. You know, then I found more. There's this great 56 concert at Zardy's Jazzland in Hollywood, like really earlier in her career. There's this all this stuff from the Olympia Theater in Paris. They released a complete Ella in Berlin, which has that insane Mac the Knife she did. But the ones that were really knocking me out, a bunch of stuff from the Crescendo Club in Hollywood in 61, 62. She played like 12 nights in a row there. And they like didn't repeat set lists at each night so that she could record every song she knew over like 12 nights, which is fucking crazy to do.
Yeah,
she's that's really cool, though. And they made this great record collection from it. But there's a thing at the Newport Jazz at Carnegie Hall where, like, during the Newport Jazz Festival in 73, they had a night at Carnegie Hall dedicated kind of to Ella. That was, like, the Chick Webb Orchestra for part of it, and then her and Ellis Larkin, because they did it's the Chick Webb Orchestra, and then it's the Chick Webb Orchestra and Ella. And then... just like Ella and Ellis Larkin, because they had done an album years before, just piano and vocals. Mm-hmm. And then it's just the jazz at Carnegie Hall, All-Stars. And then they do this whole, like, Tommy Flanagan quartet with the jazz at Carnegie Hall, All-Stars. And they... It's just a shitload of Ella with different people playing with her. And it really... That knocked me out. And this one thing I found was that... I guess this one year, like in 66, Ella and made a record called At Duke's Place, Ella Fitzgerald and Duke Ellington. And the record's really cool, but to celebrate that, they went to the Côte d'Azur that year, to the jazz festival there. And they played, like, the 26th is just the Duke Ellington Orchestra. The 27th is the Duke Ellington Orchestra again. And then there's, like, Ella sits in for three songs on the 27th of July that year. And then on, like, the 28th of July, it's like a whole half the show is with Ella, and the 29th half the show is with Ella, too. She's great with orchestras because they really swing and they can match her voice in a way. I mean, she did a lot of shows with her quartet. They're knock you out. But these ones with Duke are incredible. It's just been, I've been floored by some of the vocals, and like she's this wild combination of like, she's kind of like Clapton or someone in a way, in that like she can not only deliver the song and just really sing it, but she can solo. She just does it with her voice. And there's these whole things where it's just her and the orchestra, and she just, it's just her against some sax player, and she's just going off vocally. That, but the songs themselves are just like, a lot, my favorite stuff with her before this was always her and there's a record that she made with Count Basie, because that's the greatest swing band in existence, and she's probably the greatest swing singer. And the stuff with Basie is, it's knock your socks off. It's just, it's so powerful.
In the case of vocalists like Ella Fitzgerald, it's when they do it, they own it. We've talked about that with Aretha. I think Elvis was like that. Sinatra certainly was like that. You get these vocalists that absolutely own the song. It becomes their song. Even though it's a great song in and of itself. The Summer Wind is a great song, but nobody does it like Sinatra. Nobody. And there's some great Ella versions of it I love.
This is the first song she plays with the Ellington Orchestra on the first day she comes in and plays. So it's July. It's Côte d'Azur, 1966. This is July 27th. She comes in and they introduce her, and she does a song that actually kind of became a signature for her at some points. Maybe it already is at this point. Let's Do It, which is the silly birds do it, bees do it, even,
Yeah, yeah.
But this is what that song sounds like in the hands of someone who can really swing the shit out of it.
And that's usually, well, not usually, that's been done quite a bit as a duet, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But check this out with someone who can really swing, like Ella Fitzgerald. Just check this out. This is Let's Do It.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. When the little blue bird, who has never said a word, starts to sing, spring, spring. When the little blue bell in the bottom of the dell starts to ring, ding, ding. When the little blue clerk in the middle of his work sings a song to the moon above, it is nature that's all. Simply telling us to fall in love. And that's why birds do it, bees do it, even educated fleas do it. Oh, let's do it, let's fall in love. Sets do it, Lithuanians, and let's do it, let's do it, let's fall in love. The Dutch in old Amsterdam do it, not to mention the Finns, folks in Siam do it. Think of Siamese twins, some Argentine without means do it. People say in Boston even beans do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. And that's why sponges say do it. Oh, oyster down and oyster back. Shadow. Come on and bring me Shadow and shallow shows, English souls, do it, go for Tim, I will see a boat. uneducated, uneducated. Please do it. The Beatles and the Animals, Sonny and Cher, Elizabeth and Richard, him and her. And if 007 James Bond can do it too, well, we can do it. Maybe it's
that is a mastercrafts woman at work there. I have to apologize. Making Whoopi is what I was thinking of
for
duets. Yeah, my bad. But yeah, that is it. She, well, please, you have to talk about this being a vocalist of you know, great talents. I, as a listener, first of all, I love Ella. She's one of my all-time favorite singers. And when you, I think, posted something on Instagram this past week, I just remembered all the great performances that I, just the recorded songs that I love by her. Talk about owning them. And you could tell there, she's just, she's borrowing the melody of that song. Every once in a while, she returns to it. But then she's just gone. She's gone. She's just doing her own thing, man. And yeah. She is like a, that was excellent, the Clapton thing. She's like a guitar soloist or a sax soloist.
I mean, there are ones where she just does solo, where it's, there's no other way to describe it, it's her against Johnny Hodges or somewhere on sax. I'm like, let me play the next one. This is Satin Doll, another like total standard.
Yeah.
And she just, it's the very next song in the show, she just does it next, and it's she just crushes it.
So she's opening with these two. So you, imagine having a ticket to this.
I mean, they've been playing
thing
for about an hour at this point. You know, they've been playing for about an hour. Okay. She's just come on stage with the Duke Ellington Orchestra. She's just walked up and does like these three songs. Check this. This is Satin Doll. Check this.
Thank you. Cigarette holder, which wigs me over my shoulder. He digs me out, catching my Satin Doll. Baby, shall we go out stepping? Careful of me, go, you're flipping. Speaks Latin, my Satin.
Yeah, I mean, she could always, like, I mean, she could sing, and she could sing right up against the orchestra, too. It was no fear of hers. Like, there's a famous version of her doing Mac the Knife in Paris. I think it's in Berlin. Sorry, it's in Berlin.
Oh, yeah.
Where she's doing Mac the Knife, and she forgets the words and doesn't care. She just goes off
right. And
just starts making stuff up.
Everybody went crazy on that song anyway.
Yeah, I mean
even
just,
Bobby Darin is not singing what Kurt Vile wrote.
Yeah, I mean, well, he sticks a lot closer to this. She just forgets the words and makes it up. But she, you know, there's a... Because she's such an incredible soloist on The Voice that... I've never heard anyone do that quite like she does. I mean, there are people who scat, but she scats.
No,
with
she's
such...
not scatting. She's that's a different, like a Mel Torme, like a Van Morrison.
No, I mean, there are plenty of people who scat, but she scats on a level with the sax players and with the piano players.
Yeah, she's singing. You said it perfectly. She's singing an instrument. She's becomes an instrument.
Yeah, which is what scatting is, you know. And there are people who do it great. Like Louis Armstrong was always a great singer of scat,
but I think that's
melodically,
a scat.
But Ella, because of the range in her voice, can do things that are like, you know, jazz is hard for a lot of people because it was people really creating off the top of their heads a lot of it. And that's not something the vocalists often do as much. But she is, the next song on here is a song called Lemon Drop, which is, it's just her versus the Duke Ellington Orchestra, basically. But, you know, which comes down to her and Duke for a bunch of it. And also, he's playing the piano, I think, on this one. Because that was Jimmy Jones on that one. But I think he takes back over the piano again on this one. And his famous, like, sax player, Paul Gonsalves. There's a long stretch in the end of Lemon Drop where it's just her and Paul. I think it's Paul Gonsalves, the sax player. Just like, I mean, he's got three or four sax players. Johnny Hodges, but a bunch of people, but... I don't really know who all that is, but I think it's Paul Gonsalves on this one. Because I think Johnny Hodges is playing alto and Gonsalves plays tenor. I'm getting mixed up. I can't remember. We should play that. I want you to hear this because, like, you've just never heard a singer solo like this.
Yeah, and if I could just get back to Satin Doll before you play that. When she does the verse there about the telephone, and there's a part in there where she just goes off. She's just... completely off the reservation vocally, but she's leading, and there you could see they're playing off of her. I can't describe it, but she's going off, and then she comes back down. She's staying within the structure. She's singing the words, so it's not like scatting where you could just go wherever you want to go. She's staying within the structure of the melody, but she's just completely adventurous with it.
Well, that's why she's the greatest swing stringer of all, because she's got pocket like you would not believe.
Yeah.
She's just got an unbelievable pocket. She knows
rhythm,
right where the beat
point.
Is,
yes.
And she can leave it behind and snap right back to it on the beat. You know, she comes back around when she needs to, but she sits on the back of the beat sometimes, like so far back there, and then just like snaps forward onto it. It's very powerful, like without necessarily just belting. She's got a sense of rhythm and time, and her pocket's incredible.
Even when she goes into the falsetto, which is... You want her to do it more when she just goes up there, you know, for the note.
Yeah.
She doesn't overuse it. You know, she's just... It's just such joy in the singing.
And she hits the note on a bullseye each time. She's not...
Every time.
It's not like she's just sliding around up there. She's like, bang.
That's what I'm trying to say. It's like watching a great trapeze artist because you know she's out there. She's naked. She's going for it. She's playing with the Duke Ellington Band. It's live, and I'm sure that room is not huge, so people are on top of her.
I mean, this is a big outdoor festival,
it is.
I think.
Oh, okay.
I think it's the Côte d'Azur. I think it's a jazz festival. I'm not sure.
Oh, so it's a big...
I think it may be
it's
a big
like a
audience. But,
okay,
because
I'm sure she was used to playing in small, you know, sort of jazz clubs kind of style.
Both,
where people
though.
Are on top of you to make that kind of commitment. To a song like that is so adventurous.
Yeah, I mean, she does both. I've found a lot of things. Just her at opera houses, her at clubs, her at Carnegie Hall, and her at festivals where she's outdoors, like, just
right.
losing it. This is not Lemon Drop. Lemon Drop is on that 73 Jazz at Carnegie Hall. This is Cottontail. But this is Ella with the Duke Ellington Orchestra.
It's Duke on piano here?
I think Duke's back on piano on this one, and you'll hear it. Like, Paul Gonsalves, it is Paul Gonsalves playing the sax. Or at least soloing against Ella. I think he takes the solos. This is Cottontail.
What do you do, baby?
So yeah, that's Cottontail. There's, I mean, a lot sort of concerts have something like that where she's just, I was thinking of Lemon Drop because that's on the other concert, but man, it's just, she's not like relaxedly going doobie doo wah. She's digging into that shit.
Oh man, that's the kind of thing that goes on in your head when you're putting together the great paragraph. You know, must be the kind of thing you do when you're the great strokes of the brush when you got a painting going on. You know, like it's Hendrix doing the Star Spangled Banner. I mean, it's just so original. It's just that recording at that moment. Those two great artists just inspiring each other, going off each other. They could do that 100 times at night. That's the only time you get that. That is so cool. That is true art.
Yeah. I mean, and it's like, it's one of the great sax players of his time playing with her. Like, Paul Gonzalez is a killer, man. You know, and
she sounds like a rock singer in some of those parts. She sounds like a funk singer. She sounds like a soul singer. She sounds like a jazz singer. She's just jumping from things. She's throwing out gobbledygook, you know. She's got it all going on there, man. It's so cool. Thanks for sharing that, man. I never heard that version of that.
Yeah, she's got some stuff like on the, I think on the, on that Carnegie Hall show where she does some different songs too. She does, I Gotta Be Me, which is and she also does What's Going On, the Marvin Gaye song.
Oh, no shit.
It's a pretty great version of it too. She's just, you know, she just digs into it, you know.
I love her. I think she's one of my favorite, bar none.
Yeah, she's as good as they come singing. I mean, she's just a killer singer.
And she goes across. She swats. You know, she is not just one thing. You know, you think of Sarah Vaughan when you think of jazz singers, you know, or Billie Holiday, kind of the blues into jazz singers, you know, later on in our era, like the Van Morrison kind of. Joe Jackson had that great record, Jump and Jive, which I love. It turned me on to a lot of that kind of stuff. But there's nobody like Ella, man. She is just. She's just a totally different. She's Babe Ruth. She's Lenny Bruce. She's just not in the same. Lenny Bruce is not a comedian. He's Lenny Bruce. You know, Babe Ruth was just everything. He was great at everything. I mean, Ella's just so good. It's a shame she never. You know, she should have recorded a rock and roll record.
Yeah, you know, it's a.
She could do it all, man.
She's a great singer.
Thank you so much. I mean, I could tell what you can get. I'm gonna be listening to another minute Ella now.
Yeah, I get really caught up in it. You know.
Oh man.
And we'll do more another day because you really should hear like the bassy stuff is.
Absolutely.
Like, her Satin Doll with him is out of this world. She does an incredible version of Honeysuckle Rose. I wonder if we should close with that.
Let's close with one more Ella. Yeah.
Let's do this. This is my favorite Ella record. Because it's Ella with Count Basie, and the Basie Band is the greatest swing band ever. That's what they did. They were the great swing band.
Saw them play, sure.
Which is like the funky side of jazz in a way.
Yeah, he was old when I saw him.
I mean, she's the greatest swing singer, and this is the greatest swing band. And they made this one record together in 1963 called Ella and Basie. I always thought it was called On the Sunny Side of the Street, actually. But I think it's just called Ella and Basie, and I just thought of that because the song is what closes the album.
Which is a great... She kicks that. You going to play that?
No, I'm going to play Honeysuckle Rose, the first song on the record.
Yeah.
Just because it's... We'll close with this because, man... She just kills it.
Is this a live album or this
no,
is
no,
studio,
this is just
a record,
studio
record, right?
But
yeah,
it's
yeah.
Truly great. This is Ella and Basie.
Well, thanks a lot for listening, Underwater Sunshine.
Coming back in a week or so. Bye bye bye.
Peace.
Every honeybee fills with jealousy when they see you out with me. I don't blame them, goodness knows. Honeysuckle rose. When you're passing by, flowers droop and sigh, and I know the reason why. You're much sweeter, goodness knows. Honeysuckle rose. Don't buy sugar, you just have to touch my cup. You're my sugar. It's sweet when you stir it up. When I'm taking sips from your tasty lips, seems the honey fairly drips. Your confection, goodness knows. Honeysuckle rose. Little lady, whoop, boo, dee, doo, dee, 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 it is. Your confection, goodness knows, honeysuckle rose. So don't.